Welcome athletes, top performers, and all those looking to gain that killer instinct, that edge you need to dominate in any environment. This is the Sports Motivation Podcast, and I'm your host, Nii Shobo. I played ball and succeeded at the highest levels, and I'm now committed to showing you how you can accomplish the ambitious goals and visions that you have. This podcast is designed to teach you high-level strategy, not just fluff and hype. This will cut to the core if you let it. And by taking action on the practical and next-level advice I share, you will see results. Expect that. Expect to be more confident. Expect to be more focused. Expect to be more decisive. And expect to be more fearless. Expect to become the leader your vision needs you to become. So listen up. Take notes. Let's get to it. Welcome to the Sports Motivation Podcast. I am your host, Nii Shobo, and today I'm super excited. I am here live with Jay Abraham. And for those of you listening who do not know who Jay Abraham is, anyone who is an entrepreneur or has studied marketing, you'll be familiar with his work. But he is an expert at solving problems. He's fixed a lot of businesses. He's increased the bottom line for 10,000 plus clients. And he's one of the most sought after and well-respected marketing geniuses of our era, someone who has had an impact on far too many businesses to count. And for me personally, I was just telling Jay the story before we starting. He is someone who has, through his work, through his interviews, through his books, has allowed me to be confident enough to leave my job, as you guys know, as a firefighter last year, to be able to market myself and actually earn money doing what I do. And not just through his tactics and his marketing strategies, but through his philosophies on success, on growth and achievement. So I'm super, super excited to welcome Jay Abraham. How are you, Jay?
I'm very good. And thank you for the buildup. I should have my wife listen. She'll admire me more.
Absolutely, man. I was talking with your assistant, Desiree, out there about how it's crazy. And this is one of the things that drives me. And knowing that, you know, I get emails from people talking about the impact that my podcast has on them.
Yes.
And the fact that there can be someone who you don't know, you don't see them, but their work through, you know, you listen on audio, you listen on YouTube, can dramatically alter the course of their career. And that's what you have done for me. So I'm incredibly grateful.
And of course, thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, very excited about being here with you live. But I want to, before we dive in, I want you to give the listeners sort of a background on you, because you've obviously been doing this a long, long time. And so give us, let's go back to your teenage years, your upbringing. What brought you to where you are now? Tell us your story.
Sure. I got married the first time. I've been married a couple of different times. At age 18, and I had two children at 20, and I had the needs of somebody 40 or 50, and the business world didn't care. And the only people that would give me opportunity, not a job, but opportunity, were crazy entrepreneurs who wouldn't give me a salary, but they'd give me commission or a piece of a deal or whatever. And when you only eat when you earn, you figure out what works and what doesn't, what works better than something else. But I was very transitory. I got bored very easily and would jump not from jobs in an industry, but from industry to industry to industry. And after about 10 industries, I realized that people in one industry don't have a clue how people in the other industries market, the strategies, the business models, the distribution channels, the value creation, the competitive advantage generating. And I was able to borrow sincerely very commonplace approaches from one industry or from multiple ones, combine them and use them in an industry that had never seen them, and they would skyrocket, not because I was that bright, but because everyone else in the industry was following the herd and doing mm-hmm. the same thing and only doing a little bit more marginally better or worse. And that was the start. And then over the years, I got such hopeless curiosity that I started basically expanding my knowledge base, my industry base, and my questioning based, so I became very expansive, very frankly and clinically, with knowledge from, I think it's now about 500 industries and industries, not companies, and a lot of thousands or tens of thousands of businesses, and I've been doing it all over the world and borrowing and sharing basically concepts, approaches from one industry or multiple ones that have already been proven and are much higher performing in most cases, and safer, faster, less costly than the stuff people are using, but they just don't know about it. And I grow from meeting different people in different industries, and it's been a very interesting ride. I've done 300 major experts. Tony Robbins is a client. Damon John from Shark Tank. Ramit Sethi. Dave Asprey from Bulletproof Coffee. So I've been very blessed. I have a very diverse, and that's just a few of them, but I've got a very diverse background.
Right. So it sounds like you've, and this is one of the things that was biggest for me learning from you early on, is to not just look at problems or challenges or goals from one perspective, but to go to outside markets or to learn from different people with a different perspective. So it sounds like you were able to do that earlier. But what was, no, really, like when you were younger, was that something that was just innate in you? Or you talked about the pressure that you had, but was that just something that just decided to do consciously, or was it natural?
It's, what was it, duality. I always had an entrepreneurial bent. I had two paper routes. I would buy and sell used bicycles and rebuild them. But when I became married very young, no formal college education, I had to make a decision. Do I want to be mediocre and exist at a very menial level because I had no negotiable skills, or do I want to, you know, to take charge of my life and be in control, not controlled, be a victor, not a victim? And I chose that, and I realized, and I was, I guess, ballsy enough that I would work nights sometimes and sit. I would go to entrepreneurs who found me non-threatening and interesting, and I would sit in their office all day in the corner watching them do business, and they would share with me what happened. People would come and they'd be a little bit curious. This guy in the corner, they would tell me what had transpired on phone calls. They would take me to lunch. I was very blessed. I've had more mentors in my life, including Stephen R. Covey, who was a dear friend and an advocate. Tony, who, even though I help him, I gain from all this. So I have to learn everybody's methodology that is an expert before I can help them. But I created a distinction that I've lived by. It's called funnel vision instead of tunnel vision.
Explain it.
Okay, well, the first thing is, I'm going to give you another distinction. Optimization. Highest and best use of your time, your opportunity, your ability, your resources, your relationships. And it's a very powerful concept, but you can't really perform it optimal till you have a better understanding or context of all that's possible, the alternatives, the different paths, options, opportunities, because most people choose the lowest yielding, the most frustrating, the most dead end, the most limited, instead of using the same time, effort, opportunity cost, lifetime to invest in something that's going to pay infinitely greater rewards, both financially and emotionally, psychically.
Right.
But you got, yes, go ahead.
And why do you think people, what do you think is the cause of people looking at things from such a limited perspective? Why are they not able to look at things more creatively?
Three reasons. First, and I'll get into something that I've done a lot of thinking and research on. First of all, no one has ever illuminated or expose them to higher possibilities in a way that was not just theoretical or aspirational. They haven't shown them what is possible and showed them not just possibility, but path.
Mm-hmm. A practical level.
So I did a lot of research and I studied greatness. And here's a very fascinating reality that's very troubling, but it's also very liberating. Every human being is programmed in their DNA to be great. And not just great in one category. You want to be a great either achiever, entrepreneur, father, mother, husband, lover, contributor. You want to be great at whatever you do. You don't want to be mediocre. Mm-hmm. And yet, maybe 2 or 3% of everyone is great. Most operate at a very low level of capability. The research says the average person expends about 20% of what they're capable of, and that's linear. Mm-hmm. When you understand the upside leverage you have in thinking differently and doing things differently, in pursuing different approaches than everybody else, it emancipates, you know, quantum leaps. But back to greatness, there are three or four reasons that most people never achieve the greatness that they're programmed to achieve in all aspects of their life and that they deserve. Number one, they have no idea. First of all, you have to break greatness into all these different categories. They have no idea what it's supposed to look like, feel like, express like. So they have a frustrating aspiration that never get fulfilled. So the first thing they have to figure out is, what's greatness look like as a career person or as an entrepreneur or as a father, mm-hmm. or a mother or a husband or a lover?
Mm-hmm. The vision or the blueprint, the end result.
But what it's supposed to look like to the receiving side.
Mm.
Everyone's focused with themselves and the world doesn't care about it.
Right.
They care about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at greatness, you have to externally focus.
Mm-hmm.
So first thing is taking, and also then when you figure out what it's supposed to look like, you have to gauge, because we talked offline about the fact that many times your work entails not just the literal guidance, but a lot of emotional, a lot of private issues that have to be reconciled or addressed in order to free someone to really perform their greatness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my take on greatness is, first, you have to understand what it's supposed to look like, feel like, express like, be received like in each of these areas.
Mm-hmm.
Next, you have to gauge where you have the greatest deficiency. You might want to be great in your career, but if you look at your life, you're so, let's say, poor performing in your marriage,
mm-hmm.
or in your parenthood, or in your humanity, that you have to deal with that first.
Right. It's preventing you.
Yeah. You have to prioritize what's the logjam that once you remove it, it's going to make everything else work.
Right.
So you can't do everything at one time. That's what a mistake people make.
Mm-hmm.
You would talk about an athlete. They try to be the fastest, the strongest. You can't do everything. You have mm-hmm. to pick the priority strategically, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to do with greatness. Second, once you pick it and you go through the process, now you know, and you only learn it by studying other people you admire in each category.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to either interview or observe, distill what it is about them that impresses you.
Mm-hmm.
Conduct, context, communication, actions, eye contact,
mm-hmm.
listening, interesting, interested, you know, respect, a lot of things. And you have to define it.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are abstract.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so now you know after doing your... I mean, there's nothing in life. The secret to life is there really is no silver bullet. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a misnomer that a lot of online information sellers have disseminated, that there's some easy way to achieve whatever you want in your underwear while watching Oprah and through osmosis and positivity, it's all going to occur.
Mm-hmm.
That's BS.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not hard. It just requires a process. Don't you agree?
Absolutely.
And I was going to, one time, you know how Tony Robbins has his fire walk?
Right.
I was thinking about being known for having a jello walk and having the phrase be, it's really not that hard. So it's a double entendre.
Right.
But it isn't. So first thing is figuring out what greatness looks like in all the categories, then figuring out what element of greatness you need to do first, mm-hmm. second, third, so you have permanency and stability.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not lopsided, because when you find great moneymakers, their lives are normally lopsided. They have no balance. They have no great personal life. They have, and when they look back, I've interviewed, I've helped, I've guided so many. So you want balance.
Mm-hmm.
Balance is something few people realize that is the secret to not just greatness, but fulfillment, satisfaction, a longer, richer, happier life. So now you forgot what greatness looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got to figure out where you are on the scale versus where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a gap.
Right.
So if you want to be a pole vaulter to get from here to there, it's probably going to be very unsuccessful. You're probably better off
crashes.
Taking basically a bunch of small steps.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to figure out the safest, most achievable path, not the fastest and hardest.
Right. That's powerful. So I want to break down what you...
Does it make sense?
Yes, absolutely. You
Go
gave
ahead.
Us pretty much a recipe for greatness.
There's more.
So defining what greatness looks like. And I want to come
for
back
you,
to...
For you, not for him or her.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, and you got to be able to recognize you're not anyone else. You're you.
Right.
You're unique.
Mm-hmm.
Your greatness and mine are going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we're driven by different things. We aspire to different things. We care about different things. Our contribution level is... And it's no right or wrong.
Right. And that's such a breakthrough when... I mean, just in my work and working with people who are unclear about what greatness looks like to them. We're so focused on what we think it should look like, but the breakthrough of when you actually figure out what you truly want and coming to grips with that, that's a liberating feeling. And that's a powerful first step. But you talked about then, of course, identifying the log jams or the chokeholds or the things that are preventing you from getting there, which is so contrary to what, I mean, I know, especially with me in business, I would start off with these goals, I would define greatness, and then I would just create some plan to get there, as opposed to being more deliberate and saying, okay, what's going to prevent me from getting there so that I can
very good reframe, and you're right. But most people start step one, step two, step three. In my opinion, that's theoretical. There are very few people that can progress that way because their life is not perfect and unblemished. They've got issues that have to be reconciled,
mm-hmm.
before they can get to the end game. It's probably, you know, when you're in sports, maybe you were very fast, but you needed to work to be a little stronger.
Right.
Or to defend the line more, or whatever.
Right.
But everyone thinks that they just go step one, step two, step three.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very admirable theory. But almost every human being has log jams.
Right.
And it's not at all what most people think. They think, I want to make a lot more money. Well, first of all, is why? I mean, is it because you want to, you know, impress? Is it you want things? And why do you want the things? Is that
mm-hmm.
really going to give you the joy?
Right.
Number one. Number two, why are you unable to? And you have to look and do some deep self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are not comfortable or even knowledgeable how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Facing reality, which you talked about when, you know, you told me you had your first kid at 18.
Yes.
So very quickly you realized, and I love how you said it, the world doesn't care. Yeah. And
but they also don't care if you achieve outrageous accomplishments. They don't care either way.
Right. It's indifferent.
But that's wonderful.
Right.
There's nothing and no one holding anyone down or back but themselves.
Mm-hmm. All in here.
And I'm not just being a rah-rah positive
absolutely
thinker.
Right.
I don't deal in theory. I deal in absolute transactional reality, strategy, tactics, probability, outcome. And I'm saying this not as a motivator. I don't motivate. I just show people how much more is possible from time, effort, life, career, passion, purpose, possibility. And then they get motivated because they see how little they have allowed themselves to achieve.
Right, right. And this, and what you talked about, it's not step by step, as in, okay, you do this, then do this. You identify this vision, then it feels like, based on the logjam, oh man, I got to take like 10 steps back. But that requires a certain amount of patience and fortitude, stamina. But I find that when you do have that vision, that blueprint of what greatness looks like, that makes it a little bit easier to push through. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I would also say, ironically, we expend multiple times more energy and effort avoiding greatness than embracing it, number one. Number two, it's somewhat like a bullet train in Japan. It starts slow, but it multiplies and compounds probably more rapidly than you believe. And number three, if you don't judge yourself by the end goal, but you judge yourself by small progressive successes in each of the categories, it's much more sustainable.
And that leads me to, and this was a breakthrough concept for me that I learned in your book, Sticking Points, where you talked about the idea of breakthroughs versus optimization, yes. Right? And so a lot of people think that someone like you would come into a business, you've helped FedEx, Nike, Apple, all these companies you work with, and you come in and you give them some breakthrough idea that changes the game for them. And many times, obviously, that's probably true sometimes, but you said you go in and you focus on optimization first.
That's right.
Meaning you focus on what's already working.
That's exactly right.
And let's
see
if we can make it work a little better. And then you take the profits, the gains from that, and then you focus on the breakthroughs. Do you find that that's true in life as well?
It is. And I'll tell you something very interesting. So I'm known for a lot of distinctions. I've been doing this long enough that if you haven't created some distinctions, you don't have a lot of value in the life and the world. But one of them is the three-way to grow a business model. And it was the first expression I realized of how to harness the power of geometry in business. And if you understand how to use geometry in business or life, it is exponential. So a lot of little improvements produce hundreds of percent of aggregate improvement. I don't want to get into this, but most aspects of life can be broken down to 10 or 20 sub-processes. If right. you improve each one by a mere 10%, the totality is more like 500% or 1,000%. And I learned that early in the game. Now, to answer your question, when I go into a business, I don't start with breakthroughs. I start with what I call, I break it into two parts. Maximizing what they're already doing so that I can, as you say, produce more revenue that can then be used to invest and achieve the higher performing, safer, more profitable alternatives or additions that are going to skyrocket them. But if you change immediately what they're doing, you can kill their cash flow. Even if I think it's stupid as heck, very frankly, if it's driving their business, I don't, unless it's totally, I mean, most people, by the way, I'm interrupting, it's not an ADD moment, it's a very clarified. Most people have no idea of how anything in their business, their career, or their life is performing because they don't know how to quantify,
right.
measure. They have no metrics to compare against, so they're blind. So the first thing I do is I want to know, okay, when you do this, what happens?
Mm-hmm.
What's the result? What's it cost? What's it produce? You know, and then I look at every part of the system and I question that. I don't want to get too esoteric.
So measuring, and this was one of the things that confused me a lot, especially when I was, because I feel like when, if you are not exposed to this type of thinking, it's not necessarily, you might you might have a talent for this. Most people don't. I didn't. And it wasn't until I started learning and reading and exposing my mind to new ideas that things started to click. But I had questions, much like people listening. When you talk about measuring, right? I think I heard this first from Tony Robbins when he said you can't manage what you can't measure, right?
Well, and can I interrupt for a minute? But I forgot because I was going to take you to Tony. So the first time I was explaining to Tony the three-way grow business, and it's a very simple model, but you can increase it, it's about the three ways you grow a business. You increase the number of buyers, you increase the size of the transaction, you increase the frequency or the utility value. Mm-hmm. And if you do that only by about 10%, it's not 10%. It compounds to 33 1/3%. If you do, now it's a certain model to demonstrate it. You double it, it's 800%. When I explained that to him, he was coaching the Kings, the hockey team.
Oh, okay.
And he translated it. He said, okay, if we get 10% better at, and I don't know all the process,
right,
at defense, offense, well, all these different, and he went granular, and he showed them the cumulative is 1,000%. And the first time he did that, they killed the competition by, I don't know, 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very powerful when you understand it, and you can apply it to any aspect of your life.
Right.
And now, so I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because the question that I had, and I wanted you to clarify, is, so with measuring, one of the things that would confuse me is, like, how do you measure something like relationships? Like, it's easy to measure how much you lift in the gym or stepping on the scale. But which it sounds like what you're saying is measuring really is just knowing how specifically what you're doing is impacting the result that you're getting. So the ability to identify clearly the results that are being produced, is that as simple as measuring really is?
Well, I've never been asked this question, so it's quite good. I would add another criteria. I think you've got to invest some time. There's a word. I've got to remember what it's called. I'm sorry. My brain is failing me. But basically, codifying what performance variation is in a lot of people. Not in the superstars, unless you're that gifted, but in just excellent performers in different categories. So let's talk about family relationship. Mm-hmm. Well, you can be in a vacuum and try to create your own scale, or you can go and you can observe, evaluate, reflect on relationships you know of or you've seen and that you admire, and create a criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be points, it can be elements.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can judge where you are now in those. It doesn't matter. You can have 10 points for, you can have all these different people, and then you combine commonalities, and it doesn't matter. You want to give it 100 points, you want to give it 5 points. All you want to do is have, this is what I could be, and objectively, this is where I am.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to be, if 20 is where I could be, but I'm at 3, realize that if I got to 6, that's profound.
Right.
And you could perhaps get to 20 over time, but don't pole vault. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So you describe this in one of the books I got you here is Ray Dalio, the book by, it's called Principles. And he talks about looking
book.
At it. Yeah, absolutely. It talks about machines. And then you talked about the sub processes being like these little machines within the machine.
Yeah, and it exists in everything.
Right. And you can know which sub machines are causing the logjam. Spend your time there, being able to quantify how it's impacting the end result, tinker with it, get it right. You don't have to fix the big machine. Yeah. You don't have to, you know, total the machine. You just focus on that, and you're saying you can see geometric growth over time.
Because you break it into sub-elements, processes. But the thing I want to make really clear is that this shouldn't be intimidating. This is only critical thinking. Mm-hmm. I would imagine, unless, and I can be a little bit too sophisticated, but unless I'm being very confusing, this is more logical.
Absolutely.
Than the way we live our life, our relationship, our careers, our businesses.
Mm-hmm.
This is pragmatic.
Right.
This is not a complex or ultra creative. It's quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It's more success probable, viable, easy, predictable.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do a little bit of work, and that work requires figuring out your own criteria.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you counsel people, you're not trying to get them all to the same point, are you?
Right. No. Absolutely.
There's a different greatness or success metric for every human being.
Mm-hmm.
And if they try to be me or you, that may be so frustrating. I'll tell you another story, and this has tremendous relevancy. So I started out in my professional career being a performance-based consultant. I only got paid if somebody produced outrageous increases in profit, success, sales, etc. And if they didn't really execute, I jettisoned them because it wasn't worth my time.
Mm-hmm.
When I started doing seminars, I would share the same kind of very logical, critical thinking, pragmatic, higher performing, less effort, less risk, more satisfying methodology. And at that live event, I would raise people's level of understanding to about here, and my hand is being raised for those listening as high as I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go back home and they drop down to here.
Wow.
And now it's going about 12 inches from the table. And I'd be depressed because I lost this and I'm showing the drop.
Right.
And I had a friend who was a psychologist, but I wasn't seeing him for therapy. We're just talking about it. And he clarified my reality. He said, "You're obsessed with the drop instead of being impressed with the sustaining rise."
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I wanted him at Jay's level.
Right.
They got three times, they stayed at three times their own previous level, but that was only a tenth of where I had tried to take them. And I was mad at them for not being me.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I can relate 100%.
And everybody should relate to that because
right.
you're you.
Right.
And if you grow, I mean, there's a concept in life called crucible experiences. It means that all the advice, all the education, all the coaching is meaningfully useless unless you execute, actuate, implement, and follow through.
Right. Absolutely. And also it sounds like taking regular time to remind yourself of how far you've come and being embracing the process that is life of growth, as opposed to being obsessed with some result and being so angry or frustrated or anxious about whatever results you're not getting, but reminding yourself about the progress that you are making.
Well, people don't understand this. There's a story, and I don't remember exactly, but if you invested a penny a day every day and it doubled, that after, it's a very short period, it's $1 million.
Right.
And if you understand the trajectory of compounding, that if every, whatever the period that is progressively committed enough from and for you that you can follow through and adhere to it, you grow by 10 or 15%. If you look at where that trajectory will take you in a year or 2 years, it's profound.
Mm-hmm.
It's orders of magnitude higher than you're at now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people realize they're so eager for massive instantaneous change, which is rarely, but it's producible, but it's far more frustrating and it's not viable for most people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you keep with it and you recognize that, and your audience, it's a composite of younger people at the beginning of their career or entrepreneurial or marriage or relationship, and people who are probably midway through. But if you realize that with luck and with adherence to reasonable nutrition, mm-hmm. reasonable exercise, reasonable genetics, the 27-year-olds are going to live to be 80. The 50-year-olds are going to live to be close to 80. So if you look at this trajectory and you look at this compounding, instead of being frustrated if in 6 months you've only progressed 30%, but you keep growing upward and compounding, in a year it might be 70%. Mm-hmm. In 2 years, 250%. In 3 years, 800%.
Right.
So I think you have to reconcile your goals with your timelines.
Absolutely. And it's crazy because one of the things that is really fun, especially as I'm researching more and more people who represent greatness, especially in the realm of sports, what you find is that the ones who are the most successful, we're talking about the John Woodens of the mm-hmm. world, the Nick Sabans, the Bill Walshes, these are guys who actually don't spend any time really focusing on end results, but spend all of their time obsessing over these sub-processes,
right.
over these machines, because they know that when you do that, like Bill Walsh says, his great book, The Score Takes Care of Itself. And I find it fascinating because when I meet people like you who represent greatness in their areas, it's always the same thing. It's like you're not overly obsessed over the end result. Now, of course, you love results and you're about results, but you know the process by which to get results is to obsess over these machines, if you will, and tinker with them and be in, fall in love with growing them. And
that's exactly, and also being more committed to sustaining as opposed to jumping from one improvement to another and abandoning.
Right.
Most people, they I'll tell you another story, and it has humanistic translation. I used to have a client who was the number one authority on rental homes. Mm-hmm. And he used to tell his clients, don't buy any home until you've looked at 100, because they're all eager. They're all excited.
Right.
They want the first thing they look at. I think people have to get clear on what they want, but not just what they want, but why they want it. Mm-hmm. And reconcile that's really going to provide the combination compensation, financial satisfaction that they're seeking, because I don't think enough people understand themselves.
Right. They don't know themselves.
And that's, I mean, it's a little scary, but it's, again, I use the word liberating, emancipating, because it frees you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to think about things. I mean, obsessing about yourself and your goal, everyone says, oh, think about it all the time. To me, that is almost insanity. I think that you live your progressive pursuance of goals, but if you think about it all the time, it's a very consuming and diversionary. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to eat you alive and thwart your progress.
Right.
You may disagree.
I think it's a balance. So, and this is what's funny. I was actually talking about this with Tom Bilyeu, the founder of Quest Nutrition. And he was talking about early in his career, he was just obsessed with becoming financially successful,
yes.
right? And his attempts were thwarted and he was frustrated. And it was through those failures that he and his friends ultimately got together and decided to create a company that they wanted called Quest. It became just incredibly financially yeah. successful. And one of the things I was asking him, because Kobe Bryant is someone who I study a lot, and I did a series on him called The Film Room, where I basically broke down his mindset and tried to understand him. And early in his career, he was just obsessed with becoming the best basketball player ever, right? And what happened was, as he obsessed over that, he worked really hard, he became really great, but he found that as 10 years into his career, he's like, I don't think that goal is really the point here. And then his goal started to expand. It started to be about other players.
Yeah, building making
up.
The team better.
Right. But it was only through that progression. It's like kids, like my son is 3 and he's learning to potty train and things like that. It's a lot of times I feel like with ourselves, we don't meet ourselves where we're at. So, and this is what I was talking with Tom Billy about looking back and not regretting the fact that you wanted a lot of financial success, but also realizing that that was actually not the thing that I really wanted. That was what I wanted at the time, but I was young. I was immature at the time.
But it's why.
Exactly.
There's right? a great, if you've never watched it, there's a great TED Talk by Simon Sinek.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen it?
Start with why.
Start with the why. And everyone that I work with or speak to, I say, let's just start by why you're doing what you're doing.
Right.
Is it because it's the best for what you're trying to achieve? Do you know what you're trying to achieve? A lot of people say, I want to be the fastest growing company. I want to be the biggest. And I'll say, why? And they'll say, for distinction, I'll say, okay, do you have the management skills? Do you have the...
Mm-hmm.
And somebody might say, I want to make $1 million. And I'll say, okay, let's look at your business as it exists. And maybe the business is making 100. And mm-hmm. I'll say, if you don't change your strategy, you're going to have 10 times the staff,
right.
but more because you're going to need now management.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have 10 times the capital. Maybe you should find a different way to get there. And what do you want the $1 million for? But I think when you start questioning, you get clarity.
Right.
And clarity gives you focus.
Mm-hmm.
And focus gives you more drive and more passion and more purpose.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like knowing why you're doing something is at the essence of knowing yourself, because you're aligning with yourself. So wanting to be great, like Kobe wanting to be the best basketball player ever, wasn't a bad or a good thing. It was what he wanted, and he was clear about why.
And why? Yeah.
And much like Michael Jordan, same thing. You know, when he got cut when he was in high school, the reason why he decided to go as hard as he did towards becoming a great basketball player is simply because he wanted to get girls. He didn't want to be the guy who got cut from the basketball team.
Yes.
Now, his why has evolved.
Of course.
But one of the things that is key, I find, is and for me, this is a breakthrough for me, is being unapologetic about why I want what I want.
You don't, right? I mean, as long, I mean, I've always said, in your life, now I teach and I live a life of preeminence, and that's another discussion we can talk about if you want. But in my opinion, you have to live your own life and you have to account to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in life, you know, you have to deal with, what's possible, what's legal, what's moral, ethical, and morality, ethics, possibility, that's all in the legal's pretty cut and dry, but even that. But I mean, you don't have to justify yourself to me.
Mm-hmm.
You have to justify yourself to yourself.
Right.
And I think a lot of people have and again, they're not externally focused. And by externally focused, I'm going to be the opposite. They're focused on what others think, but they're not focused on contributing and living to interact with others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's I'm not probably very clear on this, but I think it's a very big distinction.
No, that makes a ton of sense, because what you're saying is people are focused too much on what other people are going to think of them, which is actually selfish, right? Because it's limiting. But you're saying, the strategy of preeminence is all about adding value to others.
Yeah.
And being yourself in the process. So talk about what the strategy of preeminence is, because that's really one of the core tenets of your philosophy. I know you have a lot of distinctions, but let's talk about
first of all, I'll give you the short version. The long version takes 2 or 3 hours, and I'll be very happy to give you a file you can put on your own website with it, if that will help you. You don't have to link to me. But it's a strategy, it's a philosophical strategy, a strategic philosophy that you live your life, your business, it's the fuel that drives everything. It starts with a commitment, not a desire, but a commitment to be the most trusted advisor to whomever you interact with in your life on whatever you do personally and business. I'm going back and forth. You can't do that until you resolve to be truthful to yourself. And that means you can't patronize or pander. You tell people what you believe and why, and what you believe is the best either route, action, And why? And if they don't like it, you're willing to polarize.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a long time ago it's better to be loved or hated than tolerated, because if you don't do something heinous, you're not going to really, you know, you grope enough women, you're going to be in trouble. But if you just have a philosophy that people don't like, but people love it, you're going to have people who are the greatest advocates and achievers. So, I mean, I'm very big on that. The next thing is you have to be able to put into words for other people what they're feeling, hoping, struggling with, because when you do that, you connect and bond with them at a deeper level. You have to realize if you want to be interesting, you first have to be interested. My dear friend who passed away too early, Stephen Covey, used to say, "If you know, in order to be heard, you first have to hear." And listening is a skill set that is in very limited supply, because everyone's eager, and this is where we get screwed up. I was going to use a vulgarity, but let's just say screwed up. We're so eager in conversations to cue up our point of view and intervene or interrupt the moment there's a pause, that we don't hear a word you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hear a word you're saying, and it doesn't register, as opposed to being so interested that you don't even think about what you're going to say, because your subconscious will drive it anyhow. And reflecting, listening, engaging, projecting. Next thing is you have to be committed to examine, evaluate, understand, appreciate, respect, and acknowledge how other people see life. Whether you agree with it or not, at this point in time, whether they're employers, employees, family members, friends, that's their reality.
Mm-hmm.
And no two people are having the same reality, because no two people had the same experiences. And you could even go so deep, if you want to get really granular, no two people define a word the same way. I'll give you a funny example, which is probably inappropriate in this time when there's so much sexual issues, but I used to do very large seminars. Halfway through, and I already had the trust of the audience, I would purposely come into a room 10 minutes late. And then I would apologize profoundly and profusely. And I'd say, "I'm sorry, but I just saw the most stunning woman I've ever seen in the lobby, and I was captivated." Then I'd go on for 10 or 15 minutes, and I'd come back. And I would randomly query. And I had maybe 800 people in the audience.
Right.
And they were paying $15,000. So it was big. And I would say, "What came to mind?" It was very interesting. For different genders, it was different usually. For men, it would oftentimes be either physicality, anatomy, origin,
mm-hmm.
for, you know, hair color,
right.
body parts. For women, it would be the look, the, you know, the sophistication. But if you assume that a slender European blonde woman, 22, was everybody's vision of stunning beauty, you'd eliminate 98%.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to try to appreciate that your reality is not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And even your definition of a word is not mine, because the canvas, or the let's call it the screen you project your images and definitions on are based on your unique experiences.
Right.
And when you understand this, it gives you great connectivity, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I didn't mean to get tangential.
I'm glad you did, because one of the themes that I keep hearing in everything that you're saying is it's what I call embracing reality, seeing things as they are, not wishing that they were different. I'm convinced, we're homeschooling our kids, and if I can teach my kids as early as possible to see things as they are, to not wish and hope that things were different, but instead to be curious and to be an observer,
and stay childlike all their life.
That would
not immature,
right.
But with possibilities, curiosity, flexibility.
Flexibility, because all of, if I look back at all of virtually all of the pain that I've felt in my life has been my inability to do that. My it's been me looking at a situation and saying, "Man, I wish this were different," or "Why did they do this?" But you being able to, like you saying, look at reality. And then let your strategy be based on what's true.
Yes.
And be flexible. Because one of the things that is true, I know Sigmund Freud talked about this, one of the biggest things that's going to prevent or the cause of pain for humans is relationships,
yes.
People. And I wanted, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about is...
But may I finish? Excuse me for interrupting. There's a few other very critical components to preeminence.
Yes.
And if I don't share them, I'm doing the concept... And I'm doing your listener a disservice.
Ah, yeah, please go on.
Okay, so not necessarily in order because I haven't done an explanation of this for a long time, so it might be out of order, but it doesn't matter. You can do it backwards, it'll still mm-hmm. work. You have to commit to, this is an aggregate concept, to make every time you are in anybody's life for any amount of time, for any reason, leaving them better off because you were there. And that is denominated many ways. Concurrently, you want to be a multiplier, not a diminisher.
Mm.
You want to make people greater. You want to make them happier. You want to make them feel acknowledged. You don't want to destroy them or try to be arrogant or condescending. That's selfish and it isn't fulfilling. I mean, it's all about everyone else, and that's how you get what you want by first giving people what they want or what they need. Next is you don't fall in love with yourself. You don't fall in love with your intellect. You don't fall in love with your job or your business or your house or you fall in love with your wife, but I don't mean in a braggadocious manner. You fall in love with the people you interact with.
Mm-hmm.
And you see yourself as the most positive catalyst. And you want to make sure that you leave people better off. And when you look at your life, the fact that you are on this earth doing whatever you're doing in your life, not just business or career, but personally, you left the world better off because you were in it. I spend time, and my wife thinks I'm crazy, reading obituaries. But I don't read very often the prominent ones. I read the housewife who was a den mother, and she was involved in the church kitchen, cooking for people after sermon, or the teacher that created a nonprofit. People that made a difference that aren't known. When I got, my parents are all deceased, as is one of my, I only have one sibling, my brother. But when I go to the cemetery, I spend time there, but I walk all the way back to 1820, which is far back as it goes,
mm-hmm.
and I reflect on the meaning of somebody's life. They were here, they engaged in some activity, they probably were married, they had children,
mm-hmm.
They had hope, they had dreams, they had love, they had purpose. And most of us do try. I think that one of the great lessons for the younger part of your audience is that your concept of connection is disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a there's a study that a friend of mine did. He was paid $600,000 to interview 300 of the absolute top authorities in the world on leadership. And the conclusion is, there is an emerging leadership crisis, huge. And that's because a lot of millennials don't know how to lead. They don't know how to contribute. They don't know how to collaborate. They don't know how to be part of a whole, how to make everyone better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a flaw that actually hurts you in two things: your achievement possibilities, your growth possibilities, your satisfaction possibilities. And so, what else is there? And I mean, I can go on, But preeminence is being externally focused, not being a saint. We're all imperfect, and not being so giving that you don't fulfill yourself, but not being so obsessed with you, because you can't get anything you want unless you first give other people what they want, and you can't do that until you spend the time again in a discovery of what they want. You give your wife what she wants, she'll give you everything you want. You give your employer or your employees, you acknowledge them, you grow them, you develop them, and their loyalty and follow-through will be outrageous. There's very great research on trust building. Most people don't understand what trust is all about. There's Stephen M.R. Covey, son of Stephen Covey, who did the Seven Habits, which I would recommend everyone listening reread or read if they don't know about it. But the son is the world expert on trust building, and he has discovered that people who really understand true trust building and don't do it superficially or manipulatively, but are totally authentic, produce 300% more results, 300% more achievement, 300% more loyalty, 300% faster sales, 300% longer relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But most people think trust is just basically superficial. They don't even understand it. He's broken it down to 13 characteristics. Very simple. Likewise, there's research that shows that being genuinely fascinating, not superficial or patronizing, gives you a huge advantage. And you can't be fascinating unless you resonate with the other person.
Right.
You're not fascinating because of braggadocio. You're not fascinating because of your wealth. You're fascinating because of your interest or because of your humanity, because of your humility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of young people don't grasp the irony and the contradiction of that.
Right. And it's crazy because that actually, that mindset, this, if you accept and embody the strategy of preeminence, that just makes you so much more valuable
and powerful
to everyone.
Powerful.
Right.
And people want power, but they crave power, and power is only achievable by empowering others.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's this irony in life. You want to be interesting? Be interested. You want to be loved? Be love. You want to be respected? Respect. You want to be trusted? Trust. And if you're in the wrong arena where you can't trust, get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But also question your drivers of those things, because a lot of times, very sadly, we project to others those elements that we are guilty of.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this idea of deep critical thinking and deep reflective thinking is very difficult because it can seem painful at first.
Yeah, right.
But the discoveries and the opportunities they present to you in all aspects of your life, if you act on them. And there's a great saying that a friend of mine who's also deceased, I'm getting older, used to say, more is accomplished in life by movement than will ever be accomplished by meditation.
Mm.
And he was very much into meditation, but thinking about it, hoping about it, contemplating it, equivocating, procrastinating, is not going to get you anywhere, is it?
Right. No, but you're saying that critical thinking does provide that focus, which is going to drive that action. Right?
And the pain transforms into enormous pleasure because you have clarity, you have direction, you have exacting understanding of what you're trying to do, why you're trying to do it, where you are on whatever judgmental criteria that you wish to impose on yourself, not that I wish to impose on you.
Right.
It's very freeing.
Mm-hmm. Man, this is powerful. So you were saying power, most people want power, they want success. And the logjam, if you will, is this lack of empathy, this inability to look to others and say, like, how can I help? I'm just thinking even in terms of sports, there's a lot of athletes who come to me and they're frustrated with their position on their teams and their coaches. And very quickly, it's easy to see they're not focused on adding value to the team. They're not focused.
That's exactly. They're focused on their own self, you know, self-interest performance.
Exactly.
There's an interview, and I can give it to you. I don't know if I'm at liberty to share it, but he let me share it, so probably would. Tony Robbins interviewed John Wooden in one of the most spectacular interviews I've ever heard. I've got a transcript of it. I have the audio, and I think, but I have to clarify, I could give it to you to put on your website. I got to make sure, but he was focused on making everybody the best they could be for themselves and the team, and he didn't care if they won or lost. Mm-hmm. He just cared that they played full out to their capacity singularly, but that they all worked to make each and every one better.
Absolutely, yeah. John, yeah, legend. And this very has been simple. Amazing. Right, very simple, very practical. I've got a ton more questions, but I want to be respectful of your time. So I have two questions that I would love to have answered from you. And one of them, you I can imagine what you're going to say because you've talked about a lot in the strategy of preeminence, but you talk openly about your marriages that you've had. You've been divorced. And one of the things that I've talked about with my wife a lot, I'm very open and honest about the struggles of being married.
It's
and
very challenging.
Trying to accomplish greatness, if you will, however you define it, while simultaneously being a great husband, being a great father. And one of the things that's frustrating, I feel like, is there's all these people who are quote unquote successful, and when you look behind, you're saying, okay, I wonder what type of relationships they have, and then some of them don't have relationships that work out. But I feel like no one's really given us the keys. Like, how do you do this? Like, so, and there are some people doing it, but I'm always curious to hear from people who
have
gone
answer.
Through it.
You have an
yeah.
Answer.
So, what are the keys? What have you learned about the keys to having a flourishing, amazing relationship while simultaneously achieving greatness?
Well, I'm going to give you a general philosophy that transcends just this answer.
Right.
And then I'll give you the answer. Okay.
Perfect.
So I have a belief system, which, again, I don't know if you'll share or not, and I'm not offended if you want to counter it, but I believe that in our lives, 2% of what happens to us are what you'd call acts of God. They're things we have no control of. Birth defects, tsunamis, earthquakes, and they're very tragic. 98% of what happens to us in all these different categories of our life are the result of either actions we take or don't, mm-hmm. of decisions we make or don't, of elements that are immutable drivers or deterrents of either of outcomes, positive or negative, that we either harness or let whipsaw us. Now, if you believe that, the first thing you have to do is realize that we have control of a lot more of our... I'm not a believer in no one having free will. Mm-hmm. I believe we all have free will. And if you don't like... I'm going to come to the answer first. If you don't like your body, unless you have a very unusual hormonal condition, which is this act of God, you can change it. If you don't like your job or your career, you can change it. If you don't like your relationship, you can change it one of three ways. Improve it, accept it, or escape it. Now, let's take the best option, improve it. Now, that presupposes that you came together for the right reasons in the first place. Mm-hmm. If the relationship, very candidly, was physical, and there's no dimensionality, there's no shared values, there's no hopes and dreams together, there's no sincere appreciation for the wonderment of that human being, then you know you can't. This is not meant to be gross, But you can't fix a relationship just by trying to have more or better sex.
Right.
Then that's a fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't fix a relationship by appreciating the other person more and acknowledging the other person more and accepting the fact that we are delusional hypocrites if we believe any human being is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm a very detailed, pragmatic thinker. I leave papers everywhere. I leave clothes everywhere. I leave lights on. I'm a poster boy for adult attention deficit. I leave food everywhere. And my wife very patiently accepts that.
Mm-hmm.
She has what they call peculiarities that are not congruent with my logic, but that's her. And I used to be trying to control it. And I'm thinking, why? That's right. What made her appealing to me in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think that happens in relationships is that they can get stale if we don't continually commit to invest back in them. And investing back means this in life. This is a corollary, but this too transcends the answer. In life, in business, as a human being, as a couple, you grow or you die. You don't. There's nothing in life that stays static. You either regress or you progress, and progression is very joyous. It means discovering new things you can do together. Discovering aspects of the other person that you can appreciate. Stopping to impose your beliefs totally on them and examining their realities, extending yourself. My wife, and this is funny, your sports. Okay, we have season tickets to the Clippers. We have a 50-yard line, great seats to USC. I go about once a year to respect my wife. But when I go there, she's watching the game. I don't understand anything. I don't understand play-by-play of sports. I'm looking at all, wondering how do they change from a football field to a concert? How do they change it from hockey to this? How do they make the signs go? But I respect that she loves sports. She does. She and four friends do this outrageous 5-hour tailgating. I stop drinking because I'm too gregarious and dangerous. So I'm not having the same experience. But they're having a great experience.
Right.
So they go and tailgate. I take an Uber 4 hours later and go to the game. I don't judge anymore because I'm not you and you're not me. I appreciate more and I accept more, but I've been in relationships that were started for the wrong reason. And upon careful examination, it was better to extricate myself.
Mm-hmm.
But people who endure misery, there's no excuse.
Right.
That's being, you're a wimp, you're not courageous,
mm-hmm.
and you're not being respectful of each other.
Right.
But back at how you make it better, you invest in it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a business and you don't reinvest, it dies.
Right.
If you have a body and you work out for... I used to have a 44 chest and a 28 waist. And I worked out like a monster. And then I started working out less. And then all the things that I did to build it started breaking down. And now I've got a 39 chest. Instead of 19-inch arms, they're probably 12. And they're 12 inches of... Just older skin, but you can't sustain anything if you don't reinvest at least to some level.
Mm-hmm.
And when you understand, and I don't think there's anything I've said today that isn't pretty logical.
Right.
But that's my answer. Does that help?
This helps a ton, man. It goes back to, I heard again that the idea of embracing reality, being able to see what's working, what's not. And then, of course, investing in it. I'm thinking about, just like in a business, there's sub-processes in a relationship. You know, whether that's, you know, obviously your sex life, obviously extra, you know, date nights and things like that, your communication and being able to measure those things. And
appreciate what they're interested in, even if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Because that acknowledges them.
Mm-hmm.
When you basically say, I would have a party, I can't stand people. Or you say, I'm not going to go to the game. It crushes a side of them that they define as being the collaborative connection.
Right.
And, I mean, this acknowledging the other's individuality is selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're selfish, I mean, the greatest thing you can do, the greatest thing you can do to fuel your selfishness is selflessness.
Mm, that's powerful.
Anyhow, I'm telling you what I've learned.
Right. So find someone that you want to serve, as opposed to, you know, looking at a relationship as a place to get, but you apply that strategy of preeminence to your wife, your husband, and say,
yeah,
how
absolutely.
Can I serve them better? Like, how can
I can be better, more curious? How can I celebrate you? How can I appreciate you? How can I stimulate you? And I'm not talking in the physical, although that might be it. But how can you make them better and happier if you've chosen right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're, I won't use the vulgar word, but it starts with a D, or they're not a nice person, and you were attracted for an inauthentic reason, then I think you have to come to grips with that. And I also think, and this is probably painful, I think staying in marriages for the good of the child is totally, absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If the marriage is very destructive.
Right.
Because the children get blemished worse than if they're relieved of it,
mm-hmm.
and you can devote more concentrated time and effort on them than trying to band-aid a broken relationship.
Right.
But I'm getting into deeper issues, and they're my personal philosophy.
No, and that's important, because that's a very real situation for a lot of people. And it sounds like what you're saying is, if you stay in a relationship just for the sake of the kids, the bad marriage, that will be a logjam to your kids' upbringing and their well-being.
And if you brought them into this world, you have the privilege, the opportunity, the obligation, and the delight of creating character values, ethos, integrity, morality that will make them contributors, not takers in life.
Right.
But you can't do that if you're spending 90% of your home life deflecting fights or criticizing or being criticized. That's not happiness.
Mm-hmm.
That's masochism.
Right, right. Powerful, man. That's very helpful. And I have one more question.
Certainly.
And it's about, I'm always curious when I have people that I admire personally, I wonder what they do every day. I wonder what their habits are. I know everyone has their own sort of routines, rituals, and things. For you, what are some daily habits or routines that are critical, you feel, to your success, that make you go, that these are things you got to do no matter what?
When I wake up, first thing I got to do is have a lot of coffee. But then I spend time thinking about everything. A lot of times, and I have a bigger problem because my life is so it's so dynamic, not in the word of being extraordinary, but it's so differing all the time, because I go from one industry to another, mm-hmm. from one problem to a totally different, from one Gordian knot to another. And you can go through it and not be really conscious of what you just experienced. So I try to debrief myself, not just on what interaction occurred and what I liked about what I shared and what I liked about what I observed and what I admired and what I didn't and why and what it means to just the the knowledge I gained, and because you go so fast, you don't even remember right. half the things, and that's tragic. Mm-hmm. Then I usually have, I have a lot of people that I crisscross mentor with. They're very highly knowledgeable and very interesting people, and I pick their minds, and I normally can solve or fill a void in their minds. It's hilarious. I'm totally technophobic. I don't turn on my computer, but one of my friends is one of the number world number 1 to 10 specialist in big data. Another one is very, very big in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Another one is the former senior strategist for the second or the third largest private equity fund. I don't understand any of that stuff, but I understand things they don't. Mm-hmm. And they give me, they quench my thirst for certain things that I crave and don't even know, and I do the same for them. But traveling outside your world is a key to growth mm-hmm. and discovery and value creation. You mm-hmm. can't, if you stay where you are, you'll never discover alternative realities.
Right.
And alternative realities do exist in your business, in your career, in personal life. But if you don't examine and evaluate all the different realities there are, then you can't really be invaluable and grow. And it's a little more complicated than that, but does that help?
Absolutely. So every day you're spending reflecting on
and
life
growing.
And what's gone on, what you've learned and yeah. things like that. And is there any particular way you do that? Or do you take a walk? Do you journal? How do you go
well,
about doing
that? Well, I should take a walk and I should journal. But I sit and I'd like to hope I'm a very expansive and sort of a CAT scan thinker. Mm-hmm. So I try to think about conversations, key distinctions. I think about the personalities, the interesting aspects, the communication that not just I gave to them, but they shared with me. And I just reflect. And I try to reflect every day on yesterday mm-hmm. because I don't want to forget it.
Right.
And I want to realize what I experienced that I didn't even really know I experienced. And then I'm at a point in my life where I enjoy being compensated richly for my abilities, but I enjoy interacting with humanity more. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you are. Well, I was going to say this to you. At one point I forgot, and it was very critical. People have to, your listeners have to respectfully appreciate that the odds of them staying the same person all their life are very low. And I was going to go back to this concept about relationships. The very essence that people admire in you when you meet, they become very satiated and bored with 5 years later. And that can deal with your personality, your jokes, your sexual performance, everything. So you got to constantly reinvent yourself
right.
in all relationships mm-hmm. and as a person. I'm blessed. I have hopeless curiosity. And if you study, which I'll give you one little bonus here. If you study the process of creating and evolving and innovating, there's a very simple process and it's immutable. First thing it is, you study everything you can about what you're trying to attack the problem.
Right.
And then you process all the disparate information and you try to synthesize it into a single fabric that you can make sense of. Mm-hmm. Then you try to learn everything you can about everything you can that's outside that because mm-hmm. your subconscious uses all those fibers and builds far greater. If you look at breakthroughs, and this is in the business world, but they happen in your life, the greatest breakthroughs very rarely come from the environment you live in, mm-hmm. Whether it's business, career, relational, friendship. They come from outside. In business, if you look at fiber optics, which is basically, it's known in the telecommunication world. It was created and used originally for aerospace. If you look at Federal Express, they borrowed what's called the hub and spoke distribution process that allowed the Federal Reserve Bank to clear a check overnight. If you look at medicine, Rogaine for the hair was created originally for pimples, blemishes. Viagra was created for the heart, to treat the heart. I can't remember, this is minor, but it's true. It's either roll-on deodorant or the roll-on pen was patterned after each other.
Right.
But you can't have breakthroughs if you don't transcend your rigidity of life.
Mm-hmm.
So traveling, if you think about it, anyone who's traveled, travel outside your city, your state, your country, your continent, it traveling grows you. You see different ways of thinking, doing, values, geography, food, beliefs, moralities, climate. And the more expansive, the more appreciative and deep you are, and that's what defines your growth.
Mm-hmm.
You do the same in your life.
Absolutely.
And I think I'm out of time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate this.
Okay. I hope this was useful.
Absolutely. It was amazing. Thank you so much. And this was definitely a highlight of my year. And
it was my privilege. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
If you are a high-performance athlete or an entrepreneur looking to take their results to next levels and is not satisfied with just listening to podcasts, just reading books, and actually want a coach, someone who can walk them through the systems, the mindset, and the habits that they need in order to dominate in their particular arena, then the I'm Not You coaching program is probably a good fit for you. Now, it's not a good fit for you if you're someone who does not want to invest time, does not want to invest money, and does not want to invest energy into getting those results. But if you are someone who is ready to take the next step and you're really, really committed to really getting those results that most people talk about but never get, then go to imnotyou.com/coaching and you'll get the opportunity to talk with me for 60 minutes and we'll decide whether or not this is a good fit for you. And if it is, you'll be working with me as your mindset coach. All right. Go to imnotyou.com/coaching and I look forward to meeting you.